Yes, sirree. Metallica, Fight Fire with Fire. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. That song does not necessarily represent any particular political perspective on my part. I was going to start this show off with Marty Robbins' Prairie Fire, which relates more directly to the subject we are eventually going to talk about here today, which are these crazy wildfires that are raging in the Midwest. And my show is titled While Trump Tweets the Southern Plains Burn, with guest Tom Philpott of the Mother Jones, who just wrote about that. But in the meantime, I heard about the failure to indict Portland police officer Andrew Hearst in the February 9 killing of Quanis Hayes, 17 years old, and it just made me angry. So I looked for a song with the word fire in it that somehow expressed my feelings. So I'm just going to, before we bring Tom up, who's patiently waiting, I believe from Austin, Texas, on the line, before I even introduce him, I'm going to just read this from the Portland Mercury and make a couple announcements. The police officer who killed a Portland teen in an early morning manhunt last month won't face criminal charges in the incident. Huh, what else is new? The Multnomah County Grand Jury has declined charges against Portland officer Andrew Hearst in the February 9 killing of Quanis Hayes. Say his name. News of the outcome emerged in a Facebook post earlier yesterday afternoon as a press conference, including Hayes' family, was announced for this morning. I will just say that right now. That will be this morning at 9 o'clock at the Portland building. I actually didn't print that out, but I do remember that from the Facebook, from the Don't Shoot Portland. And if you're not on the Don't Shoot Portland Facebook, go ahead and like or friend them, and you'll find out. The family of murdered 17-year-old Quanis Hayes is having a press conference to give a response to the no indictment. Join the family in solidarity as they seek immediate access to grand jury transcripts and all associated media, body cams, reports, etc. Don't Shoot PDX is supporting the family and our community as we seek justice. If Quanis had no real gun, why was he killed? They're demanding transparency now. And I'll just say also the funeral for Quanis Hayes will be held this Friday, March 24th at 2 p.m. at Emmanuel Church of God in Christ United, 4800 Northeast 30th Avenue here in Portland. The service is for family and community to come together to remember Quanis and show his family our support. Please stand with the Hayes family on Friday. Bring friends and family. All are welcome. Let me continue with this article. With the details of the morning Hayes died still very fuzzy, news of the grand jury's decision is sure to spark anger amongst community and family members who'd called for Hearst's badge in the wake of the shooting. Police say they were responding to a report of a man being robbed at gunpoint in his car the morning of February 9th near Northeast Hancock and 82nd. The suspect, the Portland Police Bureau said, was described to police as a black male in his 20s, wearing a dark-colored hooded sweatshirt and jeans. As officers were investigating that case, dispatchers received a report of a car prowler nearby, the Portland Police Bureau said. Cops set up a perimeter and began searching the neighborhood. At some point, Hearst came upon Hayes, who was black, and shot him. Police have said the teen had a replica firearm on his person. Strangely, the other police shooting, which happened that same day, they alleged that a homeless man was in possession of a replica firearm. What I've heard is there was a replica firearm nearby. Anyway, As it says, very hazy details. Since grand jury hearings are conducted in private, the police bureau's skeletal version of events is all that's known. But the pictures will almost certainly be filled in somewhat in coming weeks. And again, Don't Shoot Portland, along with the family and other community groups, are demanding that all the information be released. According to the police, Portland police, the armed robbery suspect on February 9th held the victim hostage for approximately 30 minutes in the car, then stole his Oregon Trail EBT card and an item of clothing. The victim told cops his assailant had a handgun with a camouflage exterior, which is roughly consistent with the gun that Portland Police Bureau circulated photos of after Hayes was killed. After responding to reports of a car prowler and report of an unwanted person in a yard on Northeast Tillamook, cops say they located Hayes in a side yard. He told officers he lived there, then ran, the release says. Cops say they tracked Hayes to a home on Northeast Hancock that appeared to have been broken into. Officers encountered Hayes crouching in an alcove at the home, the release says. Anyway, it goes on. You can read this on the Portland Mercury website. We have not gotten, well, there is no alternative version because Hayes himself was killed. I don't believe anyone else has stepped forward with any other eyewitness testimony. So apparently the only information that comes out, which I've been reading, and I'll just stop because, again, you can read about it on your own, and it is all information that only comes from the Portland police. And as we all know, there's a great distrust of police forces in general because of the commonality of such police killings of young black men in particular, but of course, many other people of color, and also more widely, seems to be a rather complete impunity. The number of times that police are actually indicted or brought to justice for such killings are extremely rare. And we're hoping that our new mayor, Ted Wheeler, will do more than in the past and around the country in such cases. So I said that. I'm just going to reannounce at 9 o'clock at the Portland building. There's a press conference with the family to demand transparency in this case. Okay, switch gears dramatically. As I said, my titling for this program is While Trump Tweets the Southern Plains Burn with guest Tom Philpott of Mother Jones. You may wonder why, with everything that's going on, including here in Portland, I'm talking about the Southern Plains. Well, let me explain. So massive wildfires are sweeping across Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Their climate change denying leaders will no doubt clamor for federal disaster relief from an administration that is hell-bent on downsizing government and slashing funding. Can it get any more dysfunctional? While the Pacific Northwest, here in the Pacific Northwest, we're still getting drenched all winter, all hell is breaking out in cattle country on the Southern Plains. For the second time in less than 10 years, huge wildfires have been raging out of control to little national attention, just as reports are coming out on yet another record-shattering year for global temperatures and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in 2016. So the reason I'm talking about this is because, like counterparts in Atlantic coast states facing dramatic sea level rise already in the streets of Miami and other places, politicians like Senator Imhoff and Governor Fallon of Oklahoma, not to mention their former Attorney General and now EPA Director Scott Pruitt, and Texas Governor Sam Brownback, and former Texas Governor Rick Perry, are among the most rabid climate science deniers. Where is this all going to end? To explore these strangenesses, I have invited Mother Jones magazine writer Tom Philpott to our airwaves. He's been at Mother Jones since 2011. His award-winning writing on food politics, especially, has appeared in numerous publications, and he was a co-founder in 2004 of Maverick Farms in Valle Cruces, North Carolina. He's currently based in Austin, Texas, where we find him. And for more information, you can go to his website, which you can find along with the links to his article in Mother Jones and a couple other articles I'm going to talk about on our website at kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio, where you can get all the audio and a description of all the shows I have ever done in this time slot for, gosh, going on 3 or 4 years now. Okay, so with that, hello, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. I'm glad you're with us. Thanks for patiently wading through that long introduction. The intros to your the subhead says science says a warming climate means more wildfires in southern plain states, which are all governed by deniers. So talk about set the stage. What actually set the stage climatically, meteorologically for these wildfires?
Well, so the southern plains are a pretty storied area in American history. I mean, if you think about it, it was really these states are the heart of the Dust Bowl that happened in the 30s, and what happened then was that you had this massive conversion of grassland into wheat. There was this big boom in plowing up those very grasslands that are on fire now. And what happened was it left the land vulnerable. So this is an area that has a very sort of a highly variable weather. So you get massive storms, you get droughts. This is a historic pattern in that area. So they plow up this area, put in wheat. Everything's great. There's this wheat boom that goes through the teens and the 20s, and rising prices, and so there's this sort of bubble that happens, and then all of a sudden, wheat prices plunge, the farmers try to put in more wheat, and then you get this massive drought, and now the ground is basically plowed up and exposed, and when the drought hits and you get windstorms, basically all the dirt blows off, and you get the Dust Bowl. So this is the exact same area. This is the Texas Panhandle. It's southern Kansas. It's Oklahoma. Since that time, a lot of that land has gone back into grassland. A lot of it's still in wheat production. But right there in the heart of the southern plains, they realized that, you can't really do year after year wheat. You've got these, millions of acres of grassland altogether. Not very many fire breaks. And now with climate change, this highly variable climate gets even more variable. You get longer and more steep droughts, and then you get these rapid transitions to storms. And so, the sort of perfect conditions for wildfires would be a whole lot of biomass, a whole lot of grass that then dries out. That's exactly what happened. So the area comes out of a drought a few years ago, goes through a fairly wet period, including last summer. And so you get this massive sort of bloom of grass through the area, which is great for a cattle farmer. You got plenty of fodder for your cows. A rapid transition into drought, which is what happened this year. So we get a perfect set of conditions for wildfires, and it really doesn't take much. Someone driving down a road could throw a cigarette out of a car into a field and start something. So they're not really sure how it started, but
it's not just one fire, I assume.
So what they are sure of is that the conditions were perfect. And as you said in your introduction, there was a very similar situation in 2011. And I believe these fires that are happening right now are basically coming under control now, and farmers are surveying the damage, which is massive. But these are a record, and the one that happened in 2011 was a near record. So we're getting these very, very severe events coming close upon each other.
You said damage. I understand. Hundreds, if not thousands, of cattle have been killed, and quite a few people have been killed. And the reason I was going to play that Marty Robbins song, which is slightly cheesy, but it actually is interesting. It tells the story of a cowboy who's, wondering if he can actually escape a prairie fire. So these things have been known for quite a while. They can happen very suddenly, just like, big crown fires happen in the forest, the Pacific Northwest. And if you're near them, you better get out of the way if you can.
Exactly. They, you know, so something else that happens in the Southern Plains area is you get these huge windstorms. So, you know, very, very windy conditions. And so in windy, dry conditions, if you've got a fire raging, that fire can move very, very rapidly. So as far as I know, 7 people have died. And the way that most of them die is desperately trying to get cattle out of the way of these things because, you know, like I said, a herd of cows might not pay that much attention if there's a fire raging a couple miles away. But a person's going to know that, you know, within a matter of seconds, this fire could be consuming this area where these cows are standing. And so you get people desperately trying to get these cows on the move and get them out of the way of the fire. And a couple of them just got too close, which is, you know, it's just so sad. Someone dying in the line of work like that. So as far as I know, 7 people have died. There's no count on the cattle, but it's well into the thousands. Many, many thousands of cattle have perished in the fire. And something like 2 million acres and possibly more.
And as you said in your title, did you even hear about these wildfires? So there isn't a lot of attention being paid to what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much going on in the news.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Now, and this is a fairly sparsely populated area. There's no major cities around this area, and so I think that both of those factors have really squeezed it out of. I mean, I think if you're a news junkie and you watch a lot of CNN or something, you've probably heard something, a little something about it. But, you know, it's barely making it into the front pages of the newspapers outside of the region.
And, you know, the reason I want to talk about this isn't really specifically because, you know, in a sense, as you mentioned, historically, wildfires everywhere, forests and prairies are a natural occurrence and generally a good thing for the ecosystem. The problem is, of course, when you have a you know, people either building their homes too close to forests or, as you know, people having cattle operations in there. And then, you know, the cattle suffer and the people trying to save the cattle suffer. And obviously, I'm sure some homes have probably been burned as well. So that's the problem with these fires. It may ultimately may be a good thing for the ecosystem. You know, that these are completely separate questions. But the hypocrisy of, as I mentioned, you know, people in Florida and New Jersey, you know, with Atlantic City or, you know, South Carolina, people denying the climate science, yet clamoring for disaster relief, you know, if a hurricane, you know, storm surge creates damage or in this case, these wildfires. I mean, I can only assume they'll be going to the federal government for disaster relief, you know, even though they want to have their disaster relief and continue denying their science too.
Right. I mean, I think that these ranches in the area, they were built in a different era. So they're built in the post Dust Bowl era, and they're built for a different era. They're built for an era of less volatile weather, less rapidly changing weather conditions. And I think they're going to have to adjust, first of all. I mean, I think that, you know, you're going to have to prepare your ranch and run your ranch differently if this kind of thing can happen once in a decade. I mean, these are very, very hard to control. They very quickly get out of control. And, you know, I'm not really sure what you do as a rancher, but what they're doing now is not going to work, obviously. And then, you know, I guess I don't really come down as hard on the people living there and dealing with that stuff on the ground as I do on their politicians. And not just their politicians. You know, one thing I didn't call out in my article that I think bears calling out is that there's a group called the American Farm Bureau Federation, and it calls itself the Voice of Agriculture. And it's, you know, it's very strong in all those states. And it's, you know, putting out press releases, calling, you know, sort of documenting the damage and calling for disaster relief. And I don't begrudge disaster relief in these kinds of conditions. But this group very powerful, very well-funded, is a steadfast denier of climate change. If you, I was just looking at their issues page on their website, and you know, their big issues are, they, you know, they've got several issues, but not one of them includes climate change. And in fact, they list as one of their issues energy, and they're pushing for more domestic drilling, more fracking, et cetera, et cetera, and nothing about climate change. And so you got the Farm Bureau telling people in this area, oh, don't worry about climate change. It's not real. It's not driven by humans. Our biggest problem with energy is we need more of it. We need more and cheaper energy. And then you think about their politicians. You know, I went through in my piece, you know, every one of these states, there's three states, some of the biggest, most famous climate deniers anywhere, you know, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, you know, surveyed the conditions. He went up in a plane and looked down and saw, you know, all the charred earth and talked about the unprecedented wildfires in the area and, you know, promised federal aid. And this guy is the, you know, sort of the poster child of climate denial. You know, loads and loads of money from fossil fuel interests into his campaign coffers. And he has been, you know, throwing wrenches in action to combat climate change for decades now. And, you know, Texas is, you know, where I am right now, is a joke when it comes to this. You know, politicians, you know, since George W. Bush won in, way back in the 90s, I think it was the early 90s when he won the governorship, politicians in the state have completely denied climate change. And it's only getting more extreme with our current governor, Greg Abbott. And so, I really hold these politics. I know that the people elected the politicians, but, you know, the politicians come to power not just based on, you know, we know, not just based on the will of the public, but also massive contributions from the fossil fuel industry drive their careers. And, you know, they are in the heart, in addition to being in the heart of the Southern Plain, you know, all three of those states have plenty of energy extraction. And those industries are really sticking it to the people who live there. And I think that's an important point to make.
Well, those are the earthquakes in Oklahoma causing this increasing in intensity and frequency are just dramatic. And in fact, there's, you know, studies have now firmly linked the fracking to the earthquakes.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine living there and all of a sudden your politicians have put you, you know, in the crosshairs of climate change. You know, I would say the Southern Plains are up there with the coastal areas you were talking about, that are, you know, these coastal areas that are under threat from rising sea level that also have climate, many of them also have climate change denying politicians. If there's any other region besides coastal areas that are on the real crosshairs of climate change, it's an area like that in the Southern Plains. And then you add earthquakes to the mix, which have been, by really good science, tied to fracking. And, you know, you got a case where the politicians are really, really sticking it to the people.
There's a perversity. I mean, I've been wanting to talk about the sort of angle we're getting at here for a while in terms of just the, I just think there's a sheer perversity. I think, you know, an argument can be made that psychologically these people have actually, you know, the Trump administration and all its, you know, disgusting cabinet members and hangers-on who are so thoroughly entrenched and in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry, many of them, and or the military-industrial complex or whatever, because they actually understand, either consciously or unconsciously, I think to a certain extent consciously, what's actually going on. And the only response they can have is just to exert and get more control, rather than, you know, they can't go back. You know, there's no going back. There's no actually questioning the overall fossil fuel driven industrial economy. That's out of the question. So it seems like the only response they have is to completely seize power and deny, deny, deny. That's my current theory. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite astonishing when you think about not that long ago, there were Republican there had been Republican politicians who felt the need at various times to acknowledge climate change. I think Newt Gingrich did for a while. I think, you know, even in the George W. Bush administration, which was run by oil guys as well, there was a moment when I think late in his administration when they sort of, begrudgingly acknowledged climate change. And then you skip to now, and it seemed like we might have a situation where Democrats would have the presidency and the Senate, and Democratic climate policy has not been great by any stretch, but at least you've got people who acknowledge the problem and acknowledge the need to do something about it. And to go from that to, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, all under the control of these characters, many of them straight from the oil industry or politicians, like this Scott Pruitt, straight from Oklahoma, Attorney General of Oklahoma, now Director of the Environmental Protection Agency, loads and loads of fossil fuel money and connections in his past. It really is terrifying. And as to what their mentality is and what they think they're doing, I really can't understand it. Like, I don't understand the strategy, except, I mean, I think the obvious material thing going on is that there are trillions of dollars in assets at stake, that if you acknowledge climate change and acknowledge that something has to be done about it, the value of those assets plunges. And so, if you want to keep those assets valuable and working, then you've got to not only deny climate change, but you've also got to throw wrenches into the policy process and stop any kind of action from happening. And I think, I guess that's the strategy. Where it takes us, I'm not sure. I mean, I do know that there's a lot of momentum around alternative energy, stuff like wind and solar, that, it's going to be kind of hard to stop that. But, one way that you increase that stuff is by making fossil fuels more expensive, them sort of, making them pay for their external damage that they cause, which would make them more expensive, and that would accelerate wind and solar. And that part of it is not going to happen. But wind and solar is sort of growing on its own. It's getting to where it can compete with fossil fuels at current prices, and that is encouraging. But on the policy front, it's an extremely depressing outlook right now.
Well, I'm speaking. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. Tom Philpott is my guest. As I mentioned at the outset, he has, been with writing for Mother Jones and other publications, writing for Mother Jones since 2011. And you're also a farmer, is that right?
Oh, I was a farmer for 7 years in North Carolina. I'm still involved with that project, but I can't call myself a farmer anymore. I'm here from Austin, Texas.
And what kind of operation did you have there?
It was a small, mostly vegetable operation. We did a little bit of meat stuff as well, and we also, the project wasn't just to grow food and sell it, but it was also to try to help organize the community and build a food system for the area that made more sense. So it was sort of a social project along with being a farm project. And so we did a lot of organizing the community and helping, get more farmers into the market and get access to local food to more people by, organizing around subsidized shares for our CSA and for other CSAs, getting food stamps accepted into the farmers market, stuff like that.
And of course, Portland is known for being involved in a lot of the same sort of stuff, as you probably are aware, but you're also been writing, got to writing a lot about those subjects, and now you're branching out. I'm sure you've been written more widely, and your article was about the wildfires that have been raging and apparently now largely under control in the southern Great Plains states, where climate science denial rules politically, and the fossil fuel industry rules as well. Of course, those things tend to go together. And we're talking about that and other things. And the number to call in, since this is a talk show, is 503-231-8187 to get on the air. You know, I looked up, you mentioned the perfect conditions for what's happening. This phrase perfect storm is perhaps a little overused now, but it's interesting. Anyway, I looked up Wikipedia. It's an expression that describes an event where a rare combination of circumstances will aggravate a situation drastically. So that certainly applies to the wildfires there. It certainly applies to the climate change, global warming scenario in general, with all the multiple both ecological and social feedback loops that are now happening in increasingly tight circles. We can talk about a little bit about that.
Sure.
And just lost my thought there for a second. But so the perfect storm describes all that, and it certainly describes the political situation with the Trump presidency and the dramatic, at the very time when we need. You know, if government, you know, I'm very suspicious of government regulation coming from to some extent, like a community rights critique of the entire regulatory apparatus historically. But, you know, if there ever was a chance that the regulatory system could actually kick into gear and do something about the multiple intersecting crises that we're in, this certainly is a time, and we're going completely in the opposite direction in a very frightening manner, as I said, and I think it's obviously a conscious thing. It's, I don't know if you've ever read Nafiz Ahmed stuff. He used to write for The Guardian, and I guess lost his job there because he wrote an article saying that, you know, laying out the case that what's going on with the Palestinians and Israelis is partly that there's so much natural gas that could be said to be in Palestinian territory in the seabed there off the coast, and so part of the suppression of that is of them is due to that. Anyway, that's why he lost his job. That's what he says to The Guardian. But he wrote an article basically saying that the Trump was ushered into power by a faction of the global deep state. Largely around this whole scenario of the inevitability of fossil fuels losing their value because of moves away from it, partly because of climate change, largely because all the most easily extractable fossil fuels have already been tapped out, and so we've already reached peak production. You know, historically peak production of many of the fossil fuels. So the writing is on the wall. So the global fossil fuel industry is threatened by the loss of their portfolio in many different ways, also due to, you know, the divestment movement that's picking up. So that basically this is a rear guard action by a certain faction of the global elite to retrench their power and to keep holding on to their portfolio as long as they can in a desperate and disastrous holding action. That's Nafiz Ahmed, Ahmed, who's got InSurge, I believe, is his website. I'll try to put that up on my website. Anyway, I was just wondering if you had caught wind of that. So the perfect storm of political, ecological, climatological factors seems to be upon us. But let's go to our first call, who's been waiting patiently. Barth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. To respond to your last point, those same factors allow the high ups in that medium in energy extraction to get their last gasp of huge profits and windfalls to open up the channels, as it were, for transporting to build the infrastructure that will allow them to keep this up for another 10 or 20 years, you know, because, oh, we just spent $10 billion on this pipeline, so you can't just turn it off tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what drives the whole system is speculation on all this infrastructure. And then they have to get it all out because they've spent all that money on the infrastructure. It's a terrible situation.
Well, but it's not speculation per se if they can control the people at the top, the kleptocracy here, where everybody's hand is in everybody else's pocket.
No, I just meant speculation in terms of speculative capital that is always looking for the next pool of either natural resources or bundled mortgages or whatever to invest its money in. Anyway.
True enough. Okay. Thank your guests for coming on. That's good information. I wanted to touch on a little bit of the historic. You know, the reason that we had the Dust Bowl was because they churned up all the grass and tore it out and made wheat fields, but the mechanism there was that the grasslands had evolved over millions of years, literally, to hold the soil and to hold the moisture and to be cyclical along with the droughts and water increases and to control the landform of the area for buffalo and other grazing creatures who are, you know, largely not there now.
That's exactly
and
right.
By destroying all that root structure, they freed up the topsoil, which is minute, and it was redistributed rather dramatically. The reflex now is the land mass was sequestering carbon in the grasses and in the root structure. Now that's all burned out and released. It frees the soil to be redistributed again and speeds up erosion and speeds up the need for more fossil conditioning and irrigation and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I'm going along with your perfect storm scenario.
And feedback loops, yeah.
Giving it a little more meat.
Okay, well,
yeah, that's exactly right.
Go ahead,
well,
Tom.
Then. I was just saying that's a great insight that, it, you know, the way the caller described that sort of deep history of the ecology of the region is exactly right. And you know, it's gone from a very robust ecosystem to, I think, a pretty fragile one in the last century. And, you know, now we're paying the price for it. And it does. You know, when you have one of these fires, it does contribute to the problem by releasing massive amounts of carbon in the air and opening the soil, which probably doesn't have very deep-rooted grass, to yet more erosion.
Yeah, those original perennial grasses, the very diverse, you know, multiple species of grasses and other plants was obviously a much more resilient ecosystem, a lesson for anyone everywhere because monocultures reign supreme. I just want to announce that coming up on KBOO at 9, Political Perspectives presents a conversation with Venus Hayes, the mother of Quanis Hayes, and Teresa Rayford on their quest to seek justice for Quanis Hayes, 17-year-old shot and killed by Portland police. If you didn't hear me at the outset, the Multnomah County Grand Jury refused to bring an indictment against Andrew Hurst, the Portland police officer who killed him. At 10, apparently, Air Cascadia will not be on today, so we will hear flashpoints in its entirety with Dennis Bernstein. Former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide narrowly escapes an assassination attempt. What happened and who may have done it? At 11 on Recovery Zone, we'll talk to activists about the growing case for a universal basic income. Tonight at 5, the KBOO Evening News examines what it means to be the, quote, most trusted name in reproductive health care under the Trump administration and how his executive orders on immigration threaten right-to-work laws. That's tonight at 5. And, of course, as always, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you're listening, we thank you for that. But if you're listening and not a current member, you can easily become one by going to kbo.fm and clicking on donate. So we only have about 15 minutes left. Thank you for calling, Barth. We've got Tom Philpott, a writer for Mother Jones, a food activist, and more, talking about these wildfires in the Midwest and what they mean. Been talking about it from a bunch of different angles. But let's go to our next caller, Brian, if you're still patiently waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm here, yes. And I wanted to disconnect with Tom there. I'm a fellow farmer. We have a small farm trying to do some of the same stuff that he was talking about in this area. And so it sounds like he got a real job. Excellent. And the reason I can call, I've actually been able to call into KBOO a few times in the last couple of months, whereas I normally couldn't because of this incredibly wet spring. And, you know, he's talking about those farms in the Midwest, and I had not heard about that myself. Maybe I don't read the Capital Press as thoroughly as I should, but the Capital Press is—he was speaking earlier about the Farm Bureau, and that's something that I think people should be very well aware of. And one of their mouthpieces is the Capital Press here in the Northwest, which is the farm news, but it's very highly skewed towards corporate ag. And when people hear politicians talking about what the farmers want, they need to really dig into that a little bit and see where it comes from, because the Farm Bureau does not represent our views at all. They mostly represent right. Monsanto's views through the Capital Press and other publications. So I appreciated that he brought that up. And it's interesting that they're having the fires in the Midwest, and here in the Northwest, talk among farmers is like, how do we get into the fields when it's this wet? If you care about your soil and soil structure, you can't work the soil when it's too wet, especially with the tools that most people use. And so we got an opposite problem. I had a terrible cover crop this year because it started raining so early I couldn't prep the ground, and so I had to rely on some less effective measures. And then it's so wet that I'm having a hard time getting out there. And so, we're seeing the other side of that problem, I think. And also something that he was talking about, you know, his feelings on the actual people in the Midwest that voted for these terrible politicians, he doesn't hold that against them, kind of reminded me of my feeling of where I live. I live out in East County, out more, you know, not far away from Portland, but pretty rural. And it's always amazing to me the difference in my attitudes versus a lot of my neighbors. They're very conservative, and I'm not. The funny thing is, though, that these are the same people that will support you and help you when you really need it, and they're very effective at getting things done, whereas a lot of times my rural friends that I see eye-to-eye politically are not the same when it comes to being able to get stuff done. But that's just kind of a little observation I had that kind of connected with something he said.
The paradoxes that we're all enmeshed in, yes.
Yeah, and it just amazes me that these people that are so practical and so, you know, that can get things done, how they can get misled by these politicians. It's one of those conundrums, and it's one of the things on my mind a lot. It's like, I don't understand it.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I want to clarify, it's not that I don't blame them for their votes. It's just that I hold the politicians and the people in power to a much you know, I hold them much more responsible. And I think, you know, I think that gives us a jumping off point for a conversation about, you know, why is it that in places like rural Oregon or the Southern High Plains, why are those areas so conservative and so open to the appeals of a right-wing populist like Donald Trump, or, you know, even just run-of-the-mill conservative Republicans, which have enough of a terrible policy agenda. And I think one of the things we have to ask ourselves, and it sounds like probably the listeners of the show are asking themselves this, is what sort of appeal do the Democrats offer, especially on agriculture policy? You know, if you look at the Obama administration and what it did on agricultural policy. I know farmers in the Maryland area who are you know, basically contract farmers to these giant poultry companies, and are always getting screwed by these big companies. These big companies dictate all the terms that they're working under. And Obama came into office promising to do something about this, promising to level the playing field and rein in the power of these companies. And, you know, eight years in office, he basically didn't do anything to the very, very end. He put in some rules after the election in the lame duck period. He put in some rules that had been sitting around for a while that could help these people. And I was talking to people out there who voted for Trump, people very critical of the power of big agriculture and the power of these giant companies. And they had voted for Trump, figuring that, you know, he's going to stick up for the little guy. He's got our interest.
Yeah.
And it was just so tragic to me. And, you know, it just made me think that if the Democrats, if Hillary Clinton had made more of an appeal about reining in the power of corporate agriculture.
Well, of course, her husband was in bed with Tyson Foods, so, you know.
Right. And all that stuff, you know, that we all know about the Clintons and you know, ties to various corporations, including agribusiness corporations. But if they had made more of an appeal, they may have been able to siphon off some support. Because, you know, I think we are, you know, this is sort of a little bit off the topic, but we are heading into another massive farm crisis where conventional corn and soybean farmers are seeing their, I believe, fourth consecutive year of very, very low prices. Their debt levels are rising. You know, these are, you know, farmers in the very swing states that went to Trump, like Iowa. I think Hillary Clinton was hoping to win Iowa and a couple of other states like in that region where, you know, people connected to farming, you know, might have swung the vote over to Trump. And these people are in a massive crisis, and, you know, a bit of populism in farm policy, which is not on the table, might have done something to sway them over. And of course, you know, Hillary Clinton had little to nothing to say about that. And, you know, I think that what Trump was able to do was sort of put this idea out that, you know, I know that I'm a multimillionaire, if not a billionaire, but I'm going to stick it to the big guy and stick up for the little guy. And he was successfully able to embed that idea and, you know, portray Hillary Clinton as this sort of corporate shill. And I think she could have possibly done something to get out of that by, you know, bringing some thunder on these issues, which she did not do.
Well, they're too busy trying to undermine the candidacy of Bernie Sanders to pay attention to that. Anyway, you are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you for calling, Brian. We've got another caller we'll go to in a second. We're kind of ranging far afield here, which is good. I was kind of hoping to get into some broader topics coming off of this, talking to someone with experience in food policy and agricultural policy and all the related subjects that we don't get to talk about too much here, which obviously has to do, as both you and a caller have stated, about the setting the stage for this terrible conflagrations there due to the disturbance of the original ecosystem, which, you know, if you look at nationally, that's what set the stage for everything we're going through is the disturbance of the original cultures and ecosystems of this poor mistreated continent on a poor mistreated planet, and we're unfortunately seeing the results of it. I'm not sure what exactly we can do about it except continue to fight the power and try to do things differently. Anyway, we've got Paul waiting patiently. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Two quick questions. I'll take my answer off the line. One of them is am I mistaken? I am more concerned about the rise in ocean levels worldwide having the consequences everywhere. Am I mistaken in that? And the second question, sort of off the wall, with the kind of rising paranoia about the Russians. Is there any hint that a lot of this climate denial stuff comes from Russia? Thank you.
Let me jump in and take the first one, and that is, yes, I think rising sea levels are a massive problem, and I think that one way to think about them and one way to think about reacting to them is that we need to create coastlines that are resilient and that can absorb some of the shock of this phenomenon. And so what that means is, instead of developing right along coastlines, you know, you've got to start really thinking about putting in way more natural, sort of like maintaining wetlands, maintaining coasts as vibrant ecosystems, things like oyster beds, all of these kinds of things can absorb shocks from, you know, one of the problems with rising sea levels is that you're much more prone to flooding, you know, to huge storms that cause flooding in places like the Gulf Coast. I'm sure where you guys are up in the Northwest. Obviously on the East Coast, we've seen this happen in recent years. Moving away from a hard-edged coast to a very soft-edged coast that can absorb these shocks would be the immediate and very important response. And, you know, the good thing about that is that when you do that, you make the oceans much more productive. When you have oyster beds, they're filtering water that goes out, keeping the oceans cleaner. When you maintain wetlands in coastal areas, these are engines of biodiversity. They're nurseries for fish. You revive fisheries. And then you get a vibrant local fishing economy, which then gives people an interest in maintaining that going forward. And, you know, right now in the United States, you know, we have this massive – think about how huge our coastline is, all down the West Coast, all down the East Coast, into the Gulf, et cetera. And yet we import 90% of the seafood that we eat. And imagine if – we ate more of our, and we export huge amounts of our seafood. So our fishing industry is largely an export industry. But imagine if we ate the seafood ourselves, and then took pride in the coasts and restored these coastal ecosystems. You'd have a lot of positive feedback loops instead of these horrible ones that we have now. And so I think that's the way that I think about rising sea level. And the way to respond to it, besides, you know, the generic cut greenhouse gas emissions and stop this from happening, that has to happen too. But to respond to it, I think it's all about coastal ecosystems.
Well, listen, I think we're going to have to hold off on that response to Russians. I think we certainly got our own homegrown, enough of our own homegrown climate science deniers not to impute that to Vladimir Putin. He's got enough on his plate. He's doing enough damage as it is. Anyway, I just want to sort of leave people with something practical, which I meant to talk about earlier, that there's this Portland General Electric is claims that building two new large natural gas plants is the best way to supply electricity for their customers in Portland out there in eastern Oregon. So people can do something about that by sending a message to the Oregon Public Utility Commission that Portland rejects PGE's dirty energy plan. Submit a comment today to the Public Utility Commission, say no to new gas-fired power plants in Oregon. And that goes along with a new report from Steve Horn of the DeSmog blog, who does some excellent reporting, that there's some new reports out about natural gas power plants emitting up to 120 times more methane than previously estimated. I will link to that on my page along with the other articles I linked to, including the person you've been hearing from, Tom Philpott, his article, Did You Even Hear About These Crazy Wildfires in the Midwest? And also link to, you can go to 350 PDX. They're working on this along with others about this Portland General Electric. Going to natural gas is not a good deal. So I just want to leave you with something practical, because we've been so successful here in the Pacific Northwest of beating back one after the other of these coal, oil, and gas export terminals. It's been really an amazing struggle, and we need to keep that up, even as things continue to get so far out of whack. So thank you, Tom, for coming on. I really appreciate it. Any quick last words?
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on, and I hope to visit Portland again. I've only been there very briefly, but it seems like a just amazing place, a vibrant hotbed of food activism and an amazing food shed. So I hope to make my way there soon.
Well, you got my email address, so let me know if you do. I'm glad to talk to you here again at KBOO. Thank you so much, Tom Philpott. And we got to get out of here. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Radio Zine. Stay tuned for political perspectives and more on Qantas Hayes. Thank you for listening.